about. Little BB King here on the Roundtable. It's a Friday morning, 12 minutes after 9 o'clock. The Roundtable panel, Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue, who, you know, praise God, will be back on Monday. The panel today, oh my heavens, we have a great panel for you. We have former Albany County Common Council President Helen DeFossis, a very rare appearance. Now, it's a couple of times you've been on this show.
That's right. I'm glad to be back.
You used to be a regular back in the day.
I know. I loved it, too.
So nice to have you back.
Thank you. Siena College
Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasidi, is here. He's very excited today. Job numbers are out. We'll get to that. Just stand by, Aaron.
Okay.
How you doing?
Good. Good. The first Friday of every month is the most exciting day for an economist.
Really?
Oh, wow.
You really look enthused.
Really?
The most enthused I've ever seen an economist. David Soares is here, Albany County District Attorney. Good morning.
I'm just basking in the glow of Helen DeFossis. You have to understand that she's a personal hero of mine. Was breaking down walls and ceilings long before some of the more contemporary folks who are around. And so what an honor it is to be on today.
Now, that's great. Have you not seen each other in a while?
I have not seen her. I have not seen her. She was instrumental in the movement, my movement, long, long time ago. And so just honored to be here.
That's
not to take anything away from the Pasidi Friday.
No. And Pasidi, to be fair, is in between the two of us.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
So we'll keep the hugs to a minimum at this point. Also here today is a senior fellow and visiting professor at Bennington College, founder of Beyond Plastics, and former EPA regional administrator, Judith Enck. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here at the Love Fest.
It is. Well, we love you too, Judith.
Oh, we love you, Helen.
You know, yeah, and speaking
really
of love, Mr. Warmth himself is here, WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir.
Bah humbug.
Welcome aboard, and the big show is tonight, so you're gearing up with your banjo?
No, I haven't been invited to play the banjo, but I will introduce Happy. Happy is one of the great figures in folk music, past and present, and he is a guy who we all love. If you know Happy, you love him. And he'll be out there and doing this for us, and we very much appreciate it.
And what is it he's doing for us?
Well, he's going to be leading all of us in Pete Seeger songs, and we're going to all be watching him and singing together, and he'll bring his banjo.
Okay, and this is for Pete Seeger's 100th birthday, which is today, right?
That's right, Raymond. You're, as usual, right on the money.
Okay, and I guess...
At 7 o'clock, there are still a few seats left, but I mean only a few. We have a very generous woman who said, you know, you're charging too much for the tickets, even though I know it's for the good of the cause. I'll give $1,000 and put some people on scholarship. And then somebody else heard that and put another $500 up. So there are a few of those left.
And so
it'll be great.
It's a $100 pledge, and all of the money we raise goes to the Lockbox. Our fund drive starts June 3rd. This is a fundraiser for WAMC in a celebration of Pete Seeger. It's tonight at the Linda, 7 p.m. And if you want to go, call 800-323-9262, right?
That's right. Tonight's the night. Can't call tomorrow because tonight's the night.
All right, sir. And we'll see you there. Attorney General William Barr skipped a House hearing Thursday on Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Trump-Russia report, escalating an already acrimonious battle between Democrats and President Trump's Justice Department. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said Barr had already lied to Congress in other testimony and called that a crime. Democrats raised the prospect of holding Barr in contempt. They are also in conversation with Robert Mueller about an appearance. Jerry Nadler said he hoped the special counsel would appear before the committee on May 15th and that the panel was firming up the date. We start with our political observer, Dr. Alan Chartok. Go ahead, sir.
Well, actually, I'd love to put it off on David Soares because I'm fascinated by the idea that if you hold somebody in contempt, somebody has to do the heavy lifting, and usually that would be the Department of Justice. So how did they get this done? I mean, can you put a guy in jail when the enforcement agency is not willing to participate?
I don't think we're talking about putting someone in jail. And right now, I know why Alan is coming to me first, because...
Because you're traumatized by all the banjo talk?
Well, I was traumatized by the banjo talk, but I'm eating a bit of humble pie, because weeks and weeks ago, Alan had said that Barr was a stooge for the president, and I, of course, I stood on that on my soapbox and said, this is a law and order guy. He's a prosecutor. He cannot, you know, be swayed. He's going to have to follow the law. And what we are seeing right now is worse than what I even could have imagined. And I doubt that Alan could say that he saw this far into the future to see how much of a stooge Mr. Barr has in fact become. Here's a man who is running the most important, you know, law enforcement agency in the United States, which has jurisdiction over incidents domestic and foreign. And he took an oath. He appeared in front of the body that has oversight over his office and doubled down, tripled down on the lie that he'd already told. And it was fascinating to watch him continue to try to wiggle out of the corner that he had painted himself into. And there was brilliant, you know, there were brilliant cross-examining questions coming from our senators, Kamala Harris in particular, Sheldon Whitehouse from my state of Rhode Island. But funny. I was fascinated by watching this man continue to split hairs over words like suggest. Mm-hmm. When has the word suggested become a complicated word that we need to determine whether there's a legal implication or whether it's just being used in general terms. So getting back to the issue, however, that you pointed out, Alan, you know, right now, if you're a constitutional law junkie, you are loving what you're seeing because you're seeing the outer limits and boundaries being tested over the separation of power and constitutional authority. The problem, however, is we're living it. It's not a television show that we can admire from afar. It's not a law school problem that we can debate, you know, passively. It is happening right now in real time. And I say that because there are 14 investigations right now that are currently underway in various U.S. attorneys' offices and various in cases that were referred. The question has to be, how far do those cases go, given the Attorney General of the United States of America being as corrupt a soul as he is?
Helen DeFossis has raised her hand. And you know what? We don't do that anymore now.
But since I'm a newbie and just here for the day,
I appreciate it.
I didn't want to disturb anything else. But I did want to say
we throw shoes at each other when we want to talk.
Oh, is that right? Okay. Yeah. I did want to say that as a political scientist, this is a very, very sad time for the United States of America. I feel really, really distressed by what's happening because you can see that one and or both sides are just aching for a fight. They're aching to just push this all the way to the end and see what happens. Now, Nancy Pelosi, I think, has been doing an incredible job holding her people back. She doesn't want to get into an early impeachment. She doesn't want to get ahead of the American people. I think she's doing a great job. But she's not going to be able to hold her people back too much longer either. And then we're going to have the Barrs on one side and the whippersnappers on the other. At each other at the expense of belief in American political institutions.
Judith, think.
I don't understand, and apologies for my voice.
Have allergies.
No, I just have a cold.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing.
So yeah. Boring.
Not the cold.
I don't understand how Barr could appear before the Senate and not the House the next day. Right. Lindsey Graham protected him.
Yes.
He was afraid of Congressmember Jerry Nadler. That said, I think the Democrats actually made a strategic mistake. The big reason that Barr said he wouldn't come before the House Democrats is he didn't want Democratic staffers.
Attorneys.
Questioning him. Jerry Nadler's a really smart guy. He could have handled the questioning without handing it off to staff. But I think we want to move on from Barr now. He has distinguished himself as being dishonest, not upholding the oath he took. I think Barr's old news. I want to go right to Mueller now. How do we get Mueller into the congressional seat? Because I don't think Barr is ever going to provide useful or reliable information.
So, you know, Barr fits the characteristics of a Trump appointee. That's somebody who's just a loyalist. They'll double and triple down on lies. What I don't understand, and it's getting back away from Barr and toward Mueller, is that Mueller is a smart enough guy to know that Barr is a loyalist and a patsy to Trump. So I don't understand why right after Mueller released the report that he didn't write a memo and show it to Barr and say, you publish this and you announce this with the memo, or I'm going to do it or leak it to the press.
I have an answer for you. If you recall, prior to the report being submitted, what I had stated on this airwave is the fact that as a prosecutor, you're going to have the copies of your report with redactions that are specific in three categories. You're going to have those redactions that involve ongoing investigations because you don't want to disclose that and compromise them. But you're also going to have redactions for information that is of national security. So there's multiple levels of redactions that would be contained in that report. Robert Mueller would have completed all of those things. He would have also completed an executive summary, right, that he would have provided that would have been that would have been conscious of the redactions, right? So he, in fact, did all of those things. What he couldn't, perceive, and he had no basis to actually believe at the time, was that the Attorney General of the United States of America would be as big of a pawn as he is for the President of the United States.
You mean by releasing the four-page summary, which he did not have to do?
Which he did not have
and
to
which
do.
Was so misleading.
Robert Mueller, who's sitting there as honest as the day is long, he's not going to say, well, I better do this because this guy's a stooge. He had no idea that the man is a stooge. Personal friends, they've worked together. And
but thank God Mueller has the credibility that he has, because now that he is coming forward, he really, his words stand for something. Yes. And the fact that this is an outrage and that he's expressing it is really meaningful, I think, to the American people.
Well, there's a little bit of a problem with that, Helen. I think in that the President of the United States is saying nobody who worked in any of my executive agencies, including the Justice Department, is allowed to go forward. And I think you may be overstating the idea of his outrage. He certainly wrote a very strong letter, but the letter didn't express outrage. It said you mischaracterized what we said in our report.
But for Mueller, that's
mischaracterized is outrage.
Yes,
mischaracterized is outrage. you still have a prosecutor who's he's going to be very understated because again. He's walking the tightrope of...
Exactly.
Mueller is walking a tightrope, and he's never going to say or fall into the trap of being very overtly critical, because then he becomes a political pawn, even though he is now. But he's going to be arming, the conservative right with more information to come at him with. And I just want to come back to one thing that Helen had stated earlier about Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi is between a rock and the hard place. Everyone in this room knows that if we start to talk about impeachment, what we're doing is galvanizing the far right, and we're going to help, this president. And what she had done was simply say, well, why don't we have an unofficial impeachment by subpoenaing all the records and having congressional hearings. That could be an impeachment without necessarily having an impeachment. Trump is now doubling down and trying to force – he is begging for the impeachment.
That's right, exactly.
So that he could see his numbers improve. That's where you have right now Nancy Pelosi walking the tightrope. The trap has been set for the Democrats, and I see a lot of Democrats all too willing to jump into it head first.
Right. But one last thing here, and that is that Mueller all along knew that this president wanted to fire him, right? Do we all agree on that? We know that he went to...
It's in the report.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. We know that he tried. So Mueller had to outfox the president at every stage. He did. So when he gets to the end, the president's assumption is, and the bar assumption is, he ain't going to talk out. He's not going to speak out. But in fact, he did, and he flummoxed them. So that's part of it.
Judith.
I think the next question here is, Mueller is going to leave Department of Justice payroll, I think, in the next few days. So if he's no longer a DOJ employee and he is subpoenaed to testify, what does he do? Can he appear, David?
You will see, because... Congress can, in fact, subpoena a citizen to come and testify before them. You are going to see the Trump administration come out with every single attorney that they have available to them to try to bar Mueller from testifying on the theory that what he's going to, it's executive privilege, even though it is not.
Right.
Okay.
They started last night.
They did.
Seeing right now, and Alex and Alan had originally asked the question, well, the Department of Justice is the ultimate enforcement arm. And so all of these subpoenas, if they defy the subpoenas, look, this is going to end up in court, right? And there's no question that when they go to court, you know, whether it's a conservative bench, a liberal bench, you can't deny Congress's power of oversight over the executive branch. You can't deny that.
But you can delay it.
They're
you
going to win it. They're going
you
to delay it because
it.
Of 2016. And they can just mire the entire our government in hearings and litigation, which is exactly what Trump historically has done, even in his own terrible business practices.
Right. I think the mistake that Barr and the DOJ is making here is, in Trump fashion, they wanted to win the news cycle. So you had the misleading short summary from Barr. You had the news conference without giving the reporters the benefit of reading the report. They may have won the short-term news cycle. They're going to lose the war on this one.
I hope you're right. I'm not sure.
All right, Alan, we only have about 30 seconds here.
Okay, one last thing. It's going to end up, I suspect, with all of the stalling, you're absolutely right about that, in the Supreme Court of the United States. And I know what those clowns are going to do. They're going to find a way to side with the president.
Well, you know what? In order to side with the president, you would have to dismantle, you know, 100 years of jurisprudence.
All right, we'll take a quick break here. And, you know, I've guest hosted this show lots of times, and I forgot to tell you that we have an email address, panel@wamc.org. If you would like to share your thoughts with us, keep your letters brief, no links, no attachments, no abbreviations. Do please proofread your emails, and one a day per customer. The email address, once again, is panel@wamc.org. And this little point that they've added here that I like, just remember, sarcasm is tough to translate into print. So if you got a funny quip and you think we might screw it up, don't put it in. Otherwise, you might sound, you know, not all that balanced, right?
Is it a quip or is it what Barr had suggested how he characterized
snitty?
It? Snitty.
Yes, well, it's a snitty program.
But they had to look up the other
night. Yes, can you translate snitty into writing?
We have to take a break here, my fellow snits. It's the roundtable. Hey, how you doing? It's a casual Friday here on the Roundtable. 9:33 on a Friday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. The Roundtable panel today, David Soares, Aaron Pasitti, Helen DeFosses, Judith Enck, and Alan Shartok. And even though I only mentioned the email address right before we went to the Beeb, we have a stack of emails here. So let's get to a few of them, and then we'll move on to the news that has our economist extraordinarily enthused this morning. This email came in from Jack in Olive Ridge. Could the panel weigh in on the idea of having the remit of the AG be changed to be the legal protection of the federal government and explicitly not the legal protection of the president personally, and further, that once confirmed, could not be fired by the president and with a mechanism run by Congress, such as impeachment for dismissal if needed? And that's from Jack.
Good luck, Jack. That would be a change of monumental proportions.
He's not the legal protection of the president, though, is he?
No, he's not.
No. Even though I believe Holder said he was the wingman for President Obama.
Well, Barr's the only one that didn't get the memo that his responsibilities is to protect the citizens of the United States and not one particular client, that client being in the White House. I would also, you know, with respect to, was it Jack?
Jack.
Yeah, you know, Jack, there's going to be a lot of temptation to try to change the constitutional construct to address the current issues. The current issues wouldn't be current issues if you had, in fact, courageous senators who actually did their job and held the president in check.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else? Alan?
But that's...
Well, no, Helen, go.
No, I was just going to say, that's why the Founding Fathers made it so hard to change the Constitution.
Yeah.
Because they don't want it to be, you know, affected by what's happening at a given time. Years later, maybe you can finally resolve something, but it takes a long, long time to do that. And maybe understandably so, yeah. Right?
And Alan, let's remember that every time you change, as Jack has suggested, in one direction, somebody's going to take advantage of that and make you sorry you did it.
Yes, that's right.
All right, this email came in from Tracy in the subject heading, Russia, Russia, exclamation point. And Tracy writes, yes, Dems, keep up the Russia collusion obstruction nonsense. It's working so well for you. Take it all the way through to the election, Trump 2020. And that is from Tracy.
Tracy, I would like to remind you of the election that just saw the most sweeping changes in the House. They continue to do Russian collusion, and it worked very well for the Democrats.
Boris Badenov, yes. Well done.
He's not bad.
We apologize to all our Russian listeners.
This is from Tom in Gloversville. Tom writes, this is for David Soares. What would happen if Robert Mueller tucked his unredacted report under his arm, walked into Nadler's office, handed it to him, and then claimed whistleblower protection?
Oh, wow.
I don't think that would work, because you would have a prosecutor who is divulging, you know, national secrets.
And grand jury testimony.
And grand jury testimony. So Mr. Mueller would be in a lot of trouble for the most noble of causes. Now, the way that it's supposed to work, and if you can recall, it worked when the Republicans controlled the House, right? All of the top secret information, even information that was involved in ongoing litigation, was provided to a select few because they had top secret clearance, and they were able to go to very specific rooms, there were security controlled rooms, and view the information. Why that's not being exercised right now is beyond me.
And why is the redacted portion, which is a smaller part of the report than we originally suspected it would be, why is that so important? Can you not get the body of information without seeing methods and sources and things like that?
The truth of the matter is we don't know why it's so important. That's why it's important.
Well, they did give the unredacted version to the so-called Gang of Eight. I saw Senator Warner on this. He says he's not reading it because he wants every member of Congress to see the unredacted portion.
That's something of a cop-out, yes.
I don't know how long that's going to last.
You mean he's going to hold back from reading it until everybody gets to read it?
Every member of Congress.
But that means he doesn't get to put the pressure on himself. In the meantime, he could be very important as a would-be presidential candidate.
I think
there's an opportunity for Mueller.
Warner of Virginia.
As opposed to show, you know, going in with the unredacted report, just going on the offensive and clarifying and expanding on how Barr misled the public in his initial statement.
That is the value here of Mueller. I don't put any weight on the unredacted version of the report, because the problem is, we're putting all of our chips in on something that we don't even know what it says. And so, well, how are you going to play that once you realize it's not as great as you had anticipated it would be? To me, the most important thing is to have special counsel appear before a body under oath and explain his reason for the way that in the structure of his investigation. He can explain how many witnesses, he can get into all of the work that was done by that team, and then set the record straight.
This one is from Jason in Chatham. Good morning, panel. I agree that AG William Barr is a stooge. That part is obvious. Let's not forget that special counsel Robert Mueller balked when it came to claiming that the president did, in fact, obstruct justice. He connected all the dots and then left it to someone else to state the conclusion. He should have shown some grit and made the accusation. Mueller set the table for this to happen. He shoulders some of the blame as well. That's a question the right has been asking all along.
You cannot. Okay, let me see if I can explain this in the most sensible way, okay? Mueller said, look, we can't accuse people without having a proper forum for those people to defend themselves. The Department of Justice, you know, guidelines state that we cannot indict a president. The indictment is the accusation. What he said in that report was, we cannot indict, I can't accuse, but I cannot say that what happened here isn't worthy of further exploration in the time when he can be accused. That's what he wrote. That's the report. So this idea that this was a total, you know, win for the president is just absurd.
So you have said before on this program that you can, in fact, be guilty of obstruction for a crime that didn't happen,
that's
right?
That's correct. That is correct. So here's what Barr, here's the disservice that this man, bum Barr, right? Here's the disservice that this bum has provided for the rest of the United States, right? He said, you know, well, the president was feeling as if he was being challenged in every direction. It's like, when does a prosecutor consider the emotional state of a defendant?
Can't you do that, you know, in your cases, David?
Well, you know what? You have to establish the mens rea and the actus rea. Actus Reus. And that's what you have to have a successful prosecution. That's the burden of proof. You can't take the emotional state. You know what? Yes, he did beat his wife, but man, you know, he was under a lot of stress.
Yeah, but
because,
David, the
you know,
politics
it's
of this,
absurd.
The politics of this are as or more important than the legal aspects of this. I mean, the players are playing politics big time. Even if they have to smash the country in the process, they are really playing hardball politics.
You're absolutely right. And when Barr retired the first time, what we didn't recognize was that he retired from being a prosecutor. He didn't retire from being a political stooge. He retired from being a prosecutor. And the American people were misled because they hired him to be a prosecutor when he, in fact, gave up that position a long time ago.
Well, he also lied. I mean, let's face it. I watched every bit of those hearings, the original confirmation hearings, and he seemed eminently reasonable, and he sounded like he was going to do the right thing. He had no such intention.
The report kicked the decision over to Congress, and that's what Barr was trying to block with the way he sugarcoated this. But I think we have the Mueller report. That's the book. It's literally number one, I think, on the New York Times book list.
Immediately.
Along with the redactions. We have the book. We now need the movie. I would not say impeachment hearings, but investigatory hearings where you get Mueller, McGahn, other people in the hearing, televised, saying the words that Donald Trump told me to do this. That is really what I think the House Democrats should focus on.
The House Democrats, the Democrats, one of the questions that I was really hoping that they could drill, Kamala could have drilled down on is, how do you define cooperation? Because in this initial four-page summary of the Mueller report and then your subsequent press conferences, this president fully cooperated. How do you define cooperation? He didn't appear. Right. He didn't remember when he was given, you know, a document to fill out. And his people were lying all throughout. How is that cooperation?
But the point that was made earlier, I don't remember by whom in this room, about getting control of the news cycle immediately and getting control of the interpretation of this document. That was the genius part. And we don't have a, you know, a movie would be nice. We don't have a prominent, reasonable, legitimized producer for this movie. Somebody that everybody would understand. You had the legitimacy on both sides of the argument to come forward.
You mean like Alec Baldwin?
Yeah, no, but seriously, we don't have anybody right now who has the prestige and the position to come and say, okay, here's where we got to go next, folks, because we're foundering here. We really are.
All right, two more letters, and then we'll take a quick break, and then we'll get to the exciting economic news that everyone's thrilled about. This one's from Bob in Albany. The House may not be able to arrest those in contempt, but its committees can impose daily fines on them until they comply with the duly issued subpoenas. They also have the power of the purse and can defund parts of the agencies that are stonewalling them. I don't understand why that hasn't started already. Do you? And that is from Bob.
Because that would be the Democrats, in essence, shutting down, you know, important components of the government.
You
and
bet.
We don't want to get into another shutdown.
Didn't the House have a jail at one time, or am I wrong?
No, I think that was Veterans Stadium in Philly.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Veterans Stadium, very good. No, the House did have a jail, right?
Yeah, they had a jail.
New York State Legislature.
All right, this is from Catherine, and then we'll take a quick break. Catherine writes, yes, some of the leftier segments of the party are ready to rumble, but we're dealing with a swiftly tilting playing field with deeper questions of constitutional powers and doing the right thing. Nancy Pelosi is doing an amazing job of both at this point. I agree with Judith. Forget Barr. He's useless. We need to focus on Mueller, the man with the truth. And that is from...
Oh, that's the title for the movie, Mueller, the man with the truth.
All right, we'll take a break here. The email address is panel@wamc.org. Helen DeFosses, David Soares, Aaron Pasitti, Judith Enck, and Alan Chartok are on the panel, and we'll be right back. Yeah, that's Baby King. All right.
Wow.
David Soares is feeling it here, and that's some good bumper music. You know, just for a minute here on the round table, I just want to call out and give a shout out to our engineers.
Yay.
These guys work and gals work all the time. They never get any credit. They only get blame, which for the most part is right. But in this case, he deserves some credit. Mike Bowen, thank you for your splendid job here, sterling service on the roundtable. And it is the roundtable. We have a panel today: David Soares, Aaron Pasitti, Helen DeFossis, Judith Ink, Alan Chartok, and you at panel@wamc.org. Well, when we got here this morning, Aaron Pasitti was here. He was here by about 7 o'clock in the morning, and he was running around in circles in the green room because hiring has jumped in April. U.S. employers added 263,000 jobs. That's a strong gain. The Labor Department says the unemployment rate fell to a new five-decade low of 3.6%. Here to throw cold water on that great news is our buddy, the economist, Aaron Pacific.
Ray, can we first do what he's asked us to do, and that is to take out our single dollar bills and make it rain for him while he does
make it rain. Yeah, cue the BB King music again. That'll be perfect.
Yeah, $100 bills this time.
Right. So why is this bad news?
It's not bad news. This is a remarkably strong jobs report. It's the 104th quarter of consecutive job growth. Here's the downside.
I knew there was a downside.
It's the wage growth story, in that this recovery has been going on for almost 10 years, and it's really only been the last year or two that we've seen wage growth start to outpace inflation.
But isn't that the way it's supposed to work?
Nope.
When the unemployment rate falls, you get wage growth eventually, but it doesn't happen immediately?
It's happened in every recovery since the one from the financial crisis in 2008.
And it's happening now.
But a 10-year wait is a long wait.
8 years after the fact. So if you look at so I was doing a – as I was running around in circles, I had my calculator and clipboard, and I was doing a quick back-of-the-envelope calculation. If you look at December 1969, when the unemployment rate – the last time the unemployment rate was this low, if you look back at the late 1990s when the unemployment rate was under 4%, you had wage growth around 4 and 5%. So wage growth is substantially slower than it should be, and it's taken us a lot longer to get there. And – you know, economists are still trying to figure out why this is the case. You can argue that, you know, the Trump tax cut, which was supposed to give corporations more money to hire more workers and boost their wages, is starting to work. But you're not seeing that because wage growth has been pretty much steady at 3.2% since the Trump tax cut.
3.2.
Yep.
Well said.
I'm just doing backup vocals.
But again, it's, you know, with an unemployment rate this low, it should be 4 or 5%, and we're just not seeing that. And you can attribute that to declining union membership. You can attribute that to the rise in long-term unemployment, the rise of the use of temporary workers. So wage growth should be higher. Aside from that, it's an otherwise strong report.
Well, we're lucky that...
is an otherwise strong report. This man just said that, you know, you've got a bad heart.
Yeah.
Your liver ain't as good as it's supposed to be.
Okay.
And you got a bum knee. But aside from that, you ought to be able to run tomorrow.
Can I qualify that?
Fine.
The biggest wage gains, which are where you would expect them to be, I think it was 4.5%, are going to the bottom 25th percentile of the labor force. So low-skilled workers are seeing the biggest biggest wage gains, which is positive news.
Yeah, absolutely. And you also see companies playing games. I was interested in David Farenthold, a Washington Post reporter. He had a story a few days ago at the Trump golf course in Westchester County. Many hardworking, low-wage workers, and let's say they work 60 hours in a week, the Trump management team there said, put down 40 hours this week, 20 hours next week, so we don't have to pay you overtime. And Attorney General Letitia James, I think, is investigating that. I think there's also a lot of that going on in the economy. And, you know, the number of people who are juggling a couple jobs, they don't have health insurance, that's kind of missing in a lot of these jobs reports.
I just want to ask Aaron another question as your backup singer here. The bonuses that came as a result of the Trump tax cuts, I viewed those as stunts because what they didn't do was increase wage.
That's PR because, you know, wage increases compound over time. So it's proportionally more expensive for businesses to give you a 5% raise as opposed to just giving you a one-time 5% bonus.
So Helen DeFossis.
I was just going to say that we're lucky in a way, those of us who still have criticisms of the president's policies, that he steps on his own good news. And he, you know, they have him in front of a press conference and they say, talk about the wonders of the economy. He goes right back to some of these other issues that have been making him so angry for such a long time. And he steps on his own lines.
And I know Alan's going to ask this question, so I'm just going to answer it without him asking it. Is that, you know, the unemployment rate has been coming down consistently since 2010, 2011.
2010.
Nice.
So you know, there's a lot of inertia in this. It's been, you know, 10-plus years of straight job growth. Trump doesn't really deserve any particular credit from this because the economy has been moving on inertia since, Obama's first term. Presidents will always take credit for good news. So
moving on inertia? That is. Did you just?
Yeah.
Say,
how do you do
that's
that?
That's awesome. That is a great phrase. That's my next album title, right
moving
there.
I just made that up.
I like it a lot, it's, man.
You're scaring me. Saying
you know what I love
I say
is
smart
this
things without thinking about them.
The president's report being pissetted on.
Oh yeah. Now the Fed is going to leave interest rates alone for now.
Yeah.
And that comes on a backdrop of our economic numbers, and also Stephen Moore is out of the running now.
See ya.
Conservative commentator.
Go get him, man.
He was tapped for the Federal Reserve Board by President Trump. He withdrew from consideration after losing Republican support in the Senate, largely over inflammatory writings about women. Judith, I know you wanted to talk about this.
Bye-bye, Stephen Moore. I mean, I think the context is important. President Trump has nominated 4 people now to the Federal Reserve Board of Governors. Also, Herman Cain.
Yes,
remember him?
Same thing with him.
He wasn't technically appointed. He was considered.
Moore and Cain were considered. Moore to the point where they hired a private public relations firm to try to get him through. I really loved the interviews with Moore where they would read back incredibly sexist, horrible quotes in his past. And he actually said, I was just joking.
Yeah.
That guy, maybe, I just, you know, he makes Joe Biden look like Gloria Steinem. So I am very happy to see Moore recede into the sunset.
Can we just agree that we should never mention Herb McCain's name again without saying shucky shucky, please?
Shucky shucky, please. Indeed. Well played, sir.
There's a lot of, can I chime in and just piggyback off of what Judith said? That's just absolutely horrific and offensive in terms of what he said, but independent of that, he is only second to Herman Cain, probably one of the least qualified people to be considered for a seat on the Federal Reserve Board. He was opposed to low interest rates and quantitative easing when Obama was in office, saying, well, it's going to result in hyperinflation. Inflation's right around the corner. He said that for 8 years. Inflation is still well below the 2% Fed target. And now that the unemployment rate's low and the economy's strong, he's saying we need low rates now when the economy's doing well. We didn't need them when the economy was in the dumps.
So the question is who they pick. And David Beckworth's name has been mentioned as a sort of right-of-center economist.
There's hundreds of conservative monetary economists who could get bipartisan support because they're largely technocratic. Marvin Goodfriend's name has been thrown out a couple times. These are not people that I particularly support, but they're people who understand the importance of reading the empirical evidence as it comes in, understanding what long-term economic implications their policies will have, not just another hack that will be loyal to Trump.
Alan, I know you've been trying to jump in here among all this economic mumbo-jumbo.
A lot of good people here. I'm trying to keep my verbiage to a limit, but can we all agree that this is very good news for the president?
The unemployment report?
Yes.
What?
Sure.
Yes. Is the unemployment report, you know, the low unemployment in this country, good news for this president?
Yes.
It's good news for him.
Yes, it is. As long as he doesn't walk on his own lines.
It's generally
that's one way of diminishing it. I'm not happy about it. I don't think many of us are happy about the fact that his laissez-faire approach, including nominating no goodniks to high economic jobs, which is keep your hands off the economy and let anybody do anything they want, is going to work.
I have to disagree with you here, Alan, for a second.
Sure.
Just because, you know, the places where you see Biden, you know, the current, if you're just following Joe Biden right now, it's in those states, Pennsylvania, it's going to be Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
It's going to be those states that Trump won, that Obama had won before.
True.
Now, I don't care what the economic news is going to be leading into 2016. The reality is that this economy isn't working for a vast majority of people, right? So you can trumpet all the numbers that you want. If people aren't feeling it, aren't experiencing it, you're not going to be successful making that argument.
Yeah. So, you know, the unemployment report comes out every month. What it ignores is the long-term structural trend toward inequality where, you know, beginning in 1980, prior to the advent of, you know, trickle-down economics or supply-side economics or Reaganomics, that you know, the wealthiest 1% of the population earned about 10% of all of national income. Now that's up to 25%. Mm-hmm. So the richest 1% control a quarter of the nation's income. So they're the ones that are seeing the biggest wage gains. And it's easy to ignore those things when you're focusing on the minutia of, well, the labor force participation rate went down by 0.2 percentage points, and the unemployment, blah, 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 blah. There are serious problems with employment insecurity, rising inequality, that goes back to David's point where most people are just not feeling this.
Well, you see, I told you he would rain on the parade, and that's what Aaron Pasitti does as an economist. He parses the numbers. Alan, quickly, before we go to news, remind us about tonight's concert for Pete Seeger's 100th.
Well, those of us who love Pete are really looking forward to this. The great Happy Traum will be out there. He'll be leading us in song and playing songs, Pete songs for us. We had a wonderful interview with him yesterday. Anybody wants to go online to WMC.org and hear it, more than welcome to do it.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a great night.
So it's at the Linda tonight at 7. It's That's a $100 right. pledge per ticket. It's a Pete Seeger Centennial. All the money raised goes to the WAMC lockbox, which we fill up in advance of our on-air drive June 3rd. And if you want to get your ticket for tonight's show, and they're going fast, 800-323-9262 is the number. Alan Chartok is here, Judith Enck, David Soares, Aaron Pasitti, and Helen DeFosses. It's the Roundtable Panel. Oh, and stay there. There's more to come. It's B.B. King here on the Roundtable. It's 10:06. It's a Friday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue on the Roundtable Panel, and a great panel it is. David Soares, Aaron Pasitti, Helen DeFosses, Judith Enck, and Alan Chartok are here. You know, sometimes, you may find this hard to believe, panel, but people have accused me of kind of being in bad moods at times.
No.
I know, right? Right? But you have all put me
I've
in a good mood today.
I've never seen that.
I'm usually try to be sunny, but you guys have made me even peppier today, and I appreciate that very much. This email came in from Betsy. Betsy says, "Hello, panel. I can't believe that your panel agrees with the idea that Dems should not start impeachment or even investigate because the extreme right might get a little upset. Newsflash, the extreme right is already activated. They don't need impeachment to get them excited. Why should people who care about justice be led around by a bunch of authoritarian wannabes? And anyway, what other option is there? Just be a patsy and let the Constitution be ripped to shreds? What about the rule of law?" And that's from Betsy.
Well, I want to come back on that one. I certainly understand the passion of the letter and agree with it. Nevertheless, I don't think anyone, and I think it's unfair to say that, anyone is saying don't investigate. Everybody is saying investigate, investigate, and investigate. We want the facts. The only thing that people are saying right now is that if you have an impeachment and you vote for an impeachment, which you would get in the House, the Senate will reject it, and then the president will say, look, see, I was innocent all along. It's much better to have an election, to go to an election, to have a result like you had in the House of Representatives this time, and also to gauge what the situation is.
Impeachment's going to take a long time, too. And I think what Nancy Pelosi said, that I think it was Pelosi who said it, that impeachment is too good for this president, sarcastic as that might have been.
It was very sarcastic.
But I think it highlights this could be polarizing. This has the potential to maybe take some swing voters and push them back to the Trump side.
Yep.
If they feel like he's being unfairly prosecuted in light of the Mueller report coming out, which didn't, you know, convict him of anything. So I don't know. It could be a very strategic decision on the Dems' part to just kind of, you know, keep pressure on him, but not go the impeachment route.
Well, and you don't want to go to that well of impeachment too often either. And if you do go, you want to know that you're going to be able to win this. And that's not clear yet against this president. I think Nancy is right to just wait and see what happens.
It's absolutely strategic. And Betsy, I don't think anybody in this panel or anyone that you're listening to advising to stay away from impeachment is advising because we don't agree that an impeachment is appropriate. Impeachment is very appropriate. However, if we try to understand how impeachment works, it's the House that has to investigate and draw up the charges, and it's the Senate that has to do the prosecuting of these cases. You don't have Democrats right now in the Senate. You don't have a majority there. Mm-hmm. So if you engage in the impeachment process, as Nancy Pelosi would have to do if she decided to do that, you're doing it knowing that there's no chance for success unless you have changes in the Senate.
I think, Betsy, though, her point about the right being energized is true, but I think the far left is also highly energized now. And so it's the middle that's the interesting part here in this country right now. This one's from John in Great Barrington. John, subject heading unemployment. You ready, Aaron?
I'm listening.
Okay, here we
John.
Go. Listen yeah. closely.
Ready? Ready?
There we go. Dear panel, I'm curious, if people are working more than one job, does that skew the unemployment rate? It might explain the low numbers yet slow wage growth when most of the new jobs are low wage, low benefit type.
Mm-hmm. So the Bureau of Labor Statistics does the current population survey where they interview households, and they do ask about multiple job holders. But all you need is one job to be classified as employed. So I don't have data on the number of multiple job holders. But like I said, the one bright spot in this report was the fact that low-skill workers, the bottom quarter of the poorest quarter of people who have a job, are seeing the biggest wage gains. So that's very positive news that I'm not pestidying on.
Yeah, you know, David Soares came up with that. You have to give him a dollar every time you say it.
Thank you, David.
This one's from Julie in Saratoga. Julie writes, corporations got an almost 20% tax cut. We should all be sleeping on mattresses of money. We're not. And that's from Julie.
Well, I think the report that you had on the radio this morning about health care and the increasingly large, what do they call that, that you have to meet first of all before
deductible.
You can... Deductibles that are up to $6,000, mm-hmm. $8,000, right. Whatever. How punitive those are. Right. And people, even working three jobs, can't afford good health care.
Sure. And another argument for why wage growth has been so slow is that since most health care is provided through employers, is with the rising cost of health care, employers need to devote increasing amounts of their money to, you know, non-wage benefits like health care. So it could just be a transition from giving people raises to just continuing to pay for increasingly expensive health care.
You know, we are currently living in a moment where you've had teachers that have been villainized. You have police and prosecutors that are villainized. You also have organized labor that's been villainized. Prosperity in this country has only been achieved by working families with organized labor, with strong organized labor. And now you have corporations and industry that has worked so aggressively over the last 20 years to destroy organized labor. And what we're seeing right now with people working several jobs and not having a lot of benefits is a result of not being organized.
And we give a lot of these companies our tax money to lure them to our state, a la Amazon. I mean, I know.
Here we go.
Here we go.
Well, it's
ding,
true.
Ding, ding,
it's
ding,
true.
Ding.
Here we go.
Amazon, very anti-union, very hard on workers. And yet we're offering billions to bring them to our respective states.
You've taken straws out of my life, Julie. I will not allow you to do the same thing to Amazon.
That's every firm, though. That's not just Amazon.
Every major firm is bad in terms of labor practices.
And the head is the wealthiest person in the world.
I don't want to take this too far off topic, but the New York Times published a really interesting report about the manufacturing of Boeing aircraft in South Carolina, and they specifically relocated there because of non-union workers. Mm-hmm. And you're starting to see all of these safety defects that you're not seeing in their Washington plant where the workforce is unionized.
The email address here is panel@wamc.org. In the waning moments, if you want to weigh in with a comment, panel@wamc.org. Facebook has banned Louis Farrakhan, Alex Jones, and other extremists, saying they violated its ban on dangerous individuals. The company also removed right-wing personalities Paul Nellen, Milo Yiannopoulos, Paul Joseph Watson, Laura Loomer, along with Jones' site InfoWars, which posts conspiracy theories. The latest bans apply to both Facebook's main service and to Instagram, I should say. It is being decried by some as censorship. We start with Alan.
Well, I think there's no doubt that this could turn around and bite you in the behind. You know, I'm all for what they've done here in that these are terrible, terrible people who are doing terrible things. On the other hand, can anybody else on the panel see a time when this precedent becomes used to ban people who are anti-Trump, for example, or in other ways? I think every time you say to somebody, you can't say your thing because you're too dangerous, it becomes somewhat problematic.
Facebook's a private company, and they have a terms of service agreement. They can ban whoever they want for whatever
reason they want.
Just like just like when you walk into your, you know, corporate headquarter office, that your free speech is immediately limited by the contract that you accept with your employer. So Facebook has every right to do this. I think the argument was that these people were violating the terms of service agreements by advocating violence or harassment against certain groups.
And who makes that decision, Aaron? I mean, in all honesty, I'm being put into a position I don't particularly like here because, you know, they're all reprehensible. Nevertheless, sooner or later, somebody's going to make that decision about your right to speak.
Sure. No,
it's a slippery slope, and I agree. I agree with you, Alan. I'm forced to be, you know, in a position of having to start talking about First Amendment rights and the fact that, you know, people with ridiculous ideas, those ideas should be heard so that you can see how ridiculous those ideas are. The problem here that I see with Facebook and a lot of social media is the lack of any kind of governmental control. And during this last election, we saw how an organization like Facebook, like social media, if it's unregulated, how it could be weaponized to violate all the other canons that we believe are important in our democracy. I would also say that there is an equal protection issue here as well, because why do we have such regulations for newspapers? We have regulations for, you know, airwaves, and we now know that most people get their information from social media, and that's not regulated. We have to wake up and go beyond the sort of superficial fixes that corporations like Facebook are engaged in implementing now.
Well, just for the hell of it, where
are
the regulations? Where are the regulations? Where are the regulations on newspapers? I think newspapers are pretty well free of the game, whereas people like public radio and anybody who uses an airwave is regulated.
Yeah.
Well, what I'm saying is if Helen DeFosses decided to come back and run for governor of the state of New York,
right,
and she put an ad in the the TU, that ad would have to reflect that, you know, it's coming from her campaign or that she supports it. And I think that, you know, that's the kind of regulation that I'm talking about. And when you go to Facebook, you can basically have anybody put anything up there.
You see, I think it's even worse than that. I think the real problem here is the 35% of the people who listen to this garbage. And how you deal with that, I don't know. But remember, these conspiracy people are very popular among a group of people.
You have the right you have the right to free speech. You also have the right to be dumb out loud in the United States of America.
I mean, Pete Seeger even said you have the right to be wrong in one of his songs.
Well, the unintended consequence is Alex Jones will now have an extra 3 or 4 hours a day on his hands to do even more dastardly things than hanging out on Facebook.
I just want to figure out another way to use the word inertia because I'm so impressed with the
Senate. Moving, what was that? Moving by inertia?
Moving by inertia.
Very nice.
Did we just launch Helen DeFosses' campaign for governor?
If we did, then we violated FCC rules. And Alan and I got to get out of Dodge very quickly. This one came in via email from our friend Mike. Mike writes, I'd like to thank members of the roundtable this morning for their nuanced discussion of how the economy is doing versus how everyday workers experience shifts in the economy. So that's some Pasiti praise. Overall, media coverage on job growth and the stock market often ignore the fact that everyday people don't see the same benefits as the wealthy do. What'll it take for us to have an honest conversation about this on a large scale in this country?
Independent media.
No dose.
Yeah, that's the $64,000 question.
Why is it 64?
That's
what it used to be.
The $19 trillion question.
That's a better question.
Which is the amount of U.S. GDP.
Oh, stop.
I think he just dropped the mic on me. Yeah. He threw the mic at me.
I'm sorry. To get back to the letter is that I think you're starting to see a lot of the Democratic candidates picking up on this and making it a central focus of their campaign. It has not been the part of any political campaign since FDR in terms of how to help struggling middle-class families. The fact that they're just pounding the inequality, pounding their fists against inequality and actually have some policy solutions to deal with it.
And they're coming late to the issue. You know, a lot of this inequality has been disguised by women coming into the labor force. So the family income still looks good, but it's because not because the husband got a raise, but because the wife is now working.
You have the rise of the dual income earning households. You have the rise of personal debt, and you have the decline of personal savings that all have enabled this. So, yeah, it is weight. It's very late in the game to be bringing this up, but it's better late than never.
I'll tell you what, man. I was in a good mood. You brought me down big time.
Really? Yeah,
you harshed my mellow big time. Yeah. This one is from Charlene, who writes, in NPR's discussion of the current economic report this morning, it was stated that the national workforce has actually decreased in number. What impact does this have on the unemployment rate? Also, for those unemployed who are no longer eligible for unemployment payments, how are they represented in these numbers?
Okay, so the first question is, so economists use something called the labor force participation rate, which is the sum of everybody who has a job and everybody who doesn't have a job but has looked for a job in the past 4 weeks.
And has kept looking, right? A certain amount of time?
So to be counted as unemployed, it's a very narrow definition. You have to be have actively searched within the past 4 weeks to be considered unemployed. So if you've stopped looking and have only looked for a job in the past 6 weeks, you are no longer counted as unemployed. So the unemployment rate masks a lot of those figures, and the labor force participation rate did fall from 63% to 62.8%. That could be a one-month aberration. It's declining a lot just because of the baby boomers retiring, but that does have an effect by keeping the unemployment rate artificially low. And the second question was dealing with...
Hang on, let me go to the recycling bin.
I think it was dealing with people who have exhausted their unemployment insurance.
Also, for those unemployed who are no longer eligible for unemployment, how are they represented in the numbers?
Again, if they've looked for a job in the past 4 weeks, then they qualify. If they haven't, then they're no longer counted as unemployed, which artificially depresses the unemployment rate.
All right, this question from Erica. I think Alan and Helen should go, and so we'll go to Alan first. When Bill Clinton was impeached, he was a very popular president. Even though the impeachment failed, the Republican candidate, George W. Bush, went on to win the election. Why are you so confident that the Democrats won't win the election if they impeach Trump, an extremely unpopular president? And that is from Erica in Bethel.
And Erica, thank you for putting words in my mouth. I never said that. I mean, obviously, I think the Democrats are going to win this election. And I think they're going to win it whether they impeach him or whether they don't impeach him. I just don't think it's smart. I think what you do is you lay back, you investigate like hell, you get the facts, and you go into an election and you beat the other guy's tail off. That's what I think.
All right, Helen, you may have said this, so go ahead.
Well, you don't want to go after someone with the threat of impeachment if you're not going to be able to make it, it's not going to stick.
If you're going to kill the king, kill him.
You got to kill him. Otherwise, he's going to be there to come after you.
To be clear, our legal department
this is a very violent show.
Yeah,
it is.
Our legal department would like to be clear that we're not advocating killing anyone.
That's a metaphorical phrase.
Metaphorically.
But Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham and the rest of them will protect the president and the Senate.
I believe it was Omar from The Wire that said, if you come for the king, you best not miss.
That's right.
I thought that was
some Shakespeare quotes like that.
The Wire.
Yeah. I think you're right. All right. Well, Judith Enk, what do you have in store besides a convalescing from the cold this weekend?
I'm heading down to Catskill tonight, where we're having an important meeting at 6 o'clock with this proposed toxic ash dump
proposed. I've heard this in the news, and at issue here is the fact that this quarry is leaky, right? Is that the problem?
Yeah, it's a very leaky quarry, and Wheelabrator wants to bring toxic incinerator ash to the quarry less than a half a mile from the Hudson River.
Yeah.
So tonight we're meeting at the First Reformed Church at 6 o'clock to try to get the community engaged. Mm. Wheelabrator has a 2-year head start. They've been meeting with the local government trying to convinced them. They've offered up to $1 million for Catskill to host this, and it's really environmentally very risky.
Helen DeFossis, are you in town, back in town for good now?
No, I'm just visiting.
Really?
I live in Alexandria, Virginia, and I'm on the Alexandria Democratic Committee.
Yeah. And you're a Democrat?
Yeah. Well, it's hard to tell. I'm a leftover Democrat from the 60s, mind you.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, back when they were conservatives.
Yeah.
I'll be darned. Aaron Pasitti, what's happening with you this weekend?
I am going to be listening to the re-release of Proto Martyr's first album, No Passion, All Technique. Oh,
I'm so sorry I asked. David Soares, what's up with you?
My beautiful mommy, who's 91 years old, is going back to Atlanta this weekend, and I have to bring her back to Rhode Island so that my sister can take her
back. That's good. So you got the short trip, the short leg of the trip.
I got the short trip, but she's awesome. She's amazing.
Well, that's fun, and that'll be, a four-and-a-half-hour drive out there, right?
Yeah, I drive.
Thing about Rhode Island, they got this place, Purgatory Chasm. How do you name a town Purgatory Chasm?
Well, think of what those people did to deserve that name.
That's right. My aunt's a nun who used to preach in Rhode Island. She knew about Purgatory.
Alan Shartok, we have a minute here. I know what you're doing tonight. You'll be at the Pete Seeger Show.
We'll be at the big, great Pete Seeger event. We hope everybody will join us. And it's at 7 o'clock tonight.
Okay, and if you want a ticket to that event, you should call the station. It's a $100 pledge per ticket. It is Happy Traum playing the music of Pete Seeger on what would be Pete's 100th birthday. Our number is 800-323-9262. All the proceeds from this show benefit the WAMC Lockbox. Our on-air fund drive begins June 3rd, and what we try to do is fill up that lockbox before the fund drive begins, and then Alan can take a rest, and I have to sit across from him, and I'm much happier if I can sleep in. So once again, it's 800-323.
Wait, was that an insult?
Yes, indeed. 800-323-9262. Judith Enk, David Soares, Aaron Pasitti, Helen DeFossis, Alan Shartok, thank you all for being here. Thanks to everybody who listened this week on the Roundtable panel. Lots more good stuff ahead.